Welcome to Bombshell. I'm Erin Simpson.
I'm Lauren DeYoung-Shulman.
And I'm Radha Iyengar.
And we're here for take two of our lovely podcast. I have to say that we all got up early yesterday. That was Sunday. Today is now Monday. And had a lively, fabulous conversation that was apparently totally mangled by technical difficulties. And in our defense, while we have many advanced degrees between us, none of them are in engineering or audio science or anything that would prepare you for the thousand different things we actually have to do to prepare this podcast on a regular basis.
I like to hold close to my heart that Kai Rizdahl was impressed by our sound engineering abilities. So I just, you know, when we fail, it's still impressive to Kai. Thank you.
I think that's right. And, you know, one of the things we could think about from that end is, you know, the things that are required, you know, the technical things are we each are in three different cities right now, which means we need three laptops, three high functioning Wi-Fi connections, recording devices. Radha and I both have our recording rigs. Lauren is in a more austere sort of setup. We also need childcare. We need a room to be quiet for an hour at a time. I don't know how often any of you have lives where that is allowable, but that's a useful feature. I need a computer that lets you plug a USB device into it, which means, and that runs Skype, which means that my work computer is not available. So I have to travel with a secondary computer so that we can have this conversation for you. What I'm saying is we're dealing with a lot of shit here. And so we are here to rehash this conversation because we love you, our listeners, just so much, and because we don't want Trey, our producer, to be any further disappointed in us than he already is. So with many apologies to Trey, I think we got the levels right this time. Question mark?
Question mark.
Exclamation point.
And tarabang. What are we drinking? I came straight home and opened a beer.
I'm drinking a Sauvignon Blanc, and I'm probably going to drink half a bottle of it.
I'm not drinking anything right now because I went to a winery in Minnesota earlier this afternoon.
Oh, questions. I have questions.
Yeah, so like you're exactly right. The thing is that one needs to do to wine that is grown in Minnesota to make it somewhat drinkable is probably just add a lot of sugar. So I'm just taking a pause on alcohol right now before I get a hangover at 8:20 p.m.
Yeah, like basically you're drinking Boone's Farm.
Yeah, pretty much.
I mean, no insult to the people of Minnesota. It's just not the climate where you're supposed to be doing that.
I do have to say I have had many a wine from Western New York, and the wines along Lake Erie use Concord grapes, which if you've ever wondered what grape jelly tasted like turned into wine, I know the answer.
Some of the Finger Lakes wines are pretty good.
They are. They do a good job with the dry Riesling.
Yes. I mean, I'm basically drinking overpriced Mexican beer because I bought it at Whole Foods because I'm not going to multiple grocery stores, but it's delicious and I'll be buying more. So that's where we are for the week.
What's your beer called? Sierra Cerveza or something like that?
Yes, it's the Sierra Nevada like Mexican beer. It's delicious. I mean, is there a reason I'm not drinking Modelo? I don't know. It's because the only Modelo at the Whole Foods is like a large format 40, which I have lots of questions about, but also can't discreetly drink on the beach and pretend like it's a can of Sunkist. So any hoodle.
Oh man, but my kingdom for Erin drinking a 40 on Bombshell.
Twist my arm. In the multiverse version of this podcast, we had on our good friend, Neda Bakos, and she told us all about her amazing career in the CIA and her book that details that. And we had many poignant thoughts about politicization of intelligence and how that may or may not apply to current debates about Iran. We're going to ask our listeners to imagine that conversation here for just a moment. We'll return to it at a future date, have Neda back on as a guest host or as a guest on a live version of the podcast or something else totally awesome and befitting of her stature. And until then, we're going to press on and I think do a lightning round of keeping up foreign relations, mostly focused on the G20. So what do we got, girls?
The G20, which seems like 7 years ago, but was really only like a couple of days ago, had the overall theme of the president meeting with a whole lot of foreign leaders and in any way possible selling out his senior advisors, bureaucracy, and other intelligence assessments given to him, which is not totally surprising, but in G20, it happens really, really fast and with a lot of different people. So it just feels like a lot of it is really compounded.
Do we think that he knows that he's doing that? Like, is he doing it on purpose? Like, is he really trying to pull the rug out from people and like assert some sort of dominance?
I don't know. Like, I think if he knew he was doing it, he is certainly like getting off on it in some way. But you're right. I totally right. I don't know if he actually knows he's doing it. He just sort of like likes these people. Like, he likes Putin. He likes Erdogan. He likes, well, I guess he kind of likes Xi. It's really hard to tell. I'm kind of lost in the whole like where he is on China relationship these days. But so he met with Turkey. He met with Erdogan. And that didn't really go well for like U.S. bureaucracy for a large number of reasons.
Well, to be fair, right, the relationship with Turkey is pretty complicated, and it's not clear that a good process could rescue it, right? Like, it's been fraught basically since 2003 and just sort of finds new rivulets to be weird.
They're happy with this because apparently Trump said like, oh, I know I'm supposed to do sanctions on you because you're buying Russia's S-400 air defense system, but it's cold, totally cool. I'm not going to do the sanctions even though Congress requires me to do that unless I have to give them a waiver of some kind.
So there's some separation of powers questions there, right? Like, it seems plausible that Congress would totally go ahead and try to impose sanctions.
In theory, the president has to, if he issues a waiver, it's got to be for a couple of different reasons. He's got to like sign on the dotted line saying these reasons are indeed true and accurate. And one of them is like, it's in the national security interest, which is kind of a BS reason. Another reason is that they have proof of some kind that Russia will be doing fewer cyber intrusions on the United States. Well, that's also not going to happen. And another possible exception is that whoever is buying that system is going to start buying a lot less of systems from the sanctioned entity. Well, again, that's not going to happen because they're buying the S-400s like they're buying the S-400s. So whatever reason he comes with to waive this is going to be BS. So Congress is going to be mad because Kat said the sanctions regime passed by like an astronomical number of votes. And you could easily see them creating new sanctions on Turkey that are not overridable via veto, or doing more to prevent Turkey from actually purchasing the F-35, which we're already taking steps to make sure they're not going to get F-35s, because that would be bad. Combine that with an S-400.
And there's a co-production facility in Turkey that's also in play on that note. But yes, continue.
As Rado would say, Congress is certainly going to show that they're cross in some form with administration as well as with Turkey. It's just a matter of how and when.
They're going to send a sternly worded note, or you think they'll actually like pass something? Because
I think they'll pass something. Like, they've been pretty well aligned on like, this is not cool. DOD has been saying it's not cool. CATS have passed by, like I said, it was like 97-3. That one kind of tricky bit right now is that our acting Secretary of Defense, Mark Esper, who will be acting for like another 5 minutes or so, can't actually talk to his Turkish counterpart about this because he used to work for Raytheon.
And so he's prohibited from weighing in on particular air defense systems.
Exactly. Because what we would like them to do is buy Patriot batteries. But he can't say, hey, you should buy Patriot batteries instead, because that would be a conflict of interest for him.
That's a fascinating little turn in this situation. So in addition to meeting with President Erdogan from Turkey, President Trump also met with Vladimir Putin. I don't think there was a lot of substance that came out of that other than some viral video clips of Trump wagging his finger at Putin and sort of derisively saying, don't interfere in the election. I feel like we should be shocked by this, but it just seems so par for the course that we've totally priced that into the presidency at this point.
That's right. Plus, you know, he's BFFs with Mohammed bin Salman. And sort of, so I think we've got this kind of, you know, strong man, I hurt you, you hurt me, kill all the journalists you want, break democracy, thumbs up.
Yeah. So like, he and Putin had a bonding moment over like, we both hate journalists. Oh, ha ha. It's so cute. Whereas like, Putin murders journalists. Mohammed bin Salman, as we know, the CIA, the UN and others have said was very much behind the Khashoggi murder in Turkey. And President Trump said, actually, no, nobody's ever told me that anybody really, that it was Mohammed bin Salman. It's totally cool. He's my friend. So I feel great about all of that.
Look, if he sits there during the briefings and goes, la, 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 and doesn't hear it, then maybe nobody did tell him.
I mean, I have to say, like, I've never been the biggest, you know, advocate or, you know, kind of zealot for values-based foreign policy or about putting human rights at the center of U.S. foreign policy. But even this, I mean, makes my skin crawl more than a little bit. I mean, you sort of take the Putin MBS meetings at the G20 and then add on this kind of propaganda play at the DMZ with Kim Jong-un, which we'll get to in a minute. And it's like a world tour, not just of like, you know, I mean, I am in favor of like, you should negotiate with your adversaries, right? Like you should not just like wall off everyone. I think we should have diplomatic relations, you know, with Cuba. I think we should engage with Iran, but I think you have to do those understanding that, you know, photo ops and, you know, the first visit of an American president to your soil in however many generations is a massive propaganda coup. And we should, you know, that should be in exchange for some sort of progress or some other, you know, lifting of restrictions. And it just seems so weird to have the president clearly so comfortable with these men, right, who leave some pretty abhorrent regimes, and clearly so uncomfortable with Angela Merkel or Theresa May or even, you know, Macron in France. I don't know. It's just, it's striking. It doesn't tell us anything we don't already know, but it's such a visceral reminder of the direction this White House has tried to take American foreign policy. And it's very bizarre to me.
I mean, Aaron, you're really hitting on the point that there is a lot of space between the sort of values-based foreign policy and where we are now, in which you do strategically engage with these folks and you maybe even have negotiations, you give concessions north. There's a, like a strategic element that could be reasonable in this, but when it's played up as the president actually enjoying slash preferring the company of really some of the most brutal leaders of countries globally.
Absolutely.
You know, sort of liberal democratic leaders who he disagrees with. That's, I think, what makes it feel so, I think the technical term is icky.
Speaking of icky, there was also, I saw something about the description that the president basically took his children to the G20 instead of his like most strategic advisors. And then in particular, Ivanka Trump was present at all these fairly high profile events. There were several videos that went sort of viral. The reflection was like, you know, basically, you know, the U.S. is not a constitutional monarchy. Like your children don't have a place at the table when it comes to like policy declarations or whatever.
And I think there have been some really amazing, like social media is great for many things and it is capturing moments visually and then making everyone see them. So there's like Ivanka Trump speaking on economic empowerment of women, following Christine Lagarde, the female head right. of the IMF. And I feel like Christine Lagarde's facial expression along with Angela Merkel's were really excellent. And then of course there's the hashtag unwanted Ivanka Twitter meme that is really amazing. And some of the photos I think are really worth seeing after Ivanka inserted herself in a conversation with a number of leaders at the G20 to, I don't know, chit chat like it was a cocktail party and not a discussion of global leaders on major issues of international importance.
And I think the thing is that, like, you know, she's not like a teenager in the White House, right? This is not like someone being awkward at a state dinner or going with their parents on a state visit, you know, in a like Amy Carter or Chelsea Clinton or the Bush daughters, you know, or something, right? Like, she has been put into this role by her father. She's accepted and continued in this role and is in that seat and in those engagements instead of, I don't know, diplomats. Or somebody from, you know, the U.S., you know, from USTR or something. And it just speaks to the lack of process and the lack of seriousness with which these interactions are treated, that they're treated as, you know, essentially as photo ops as opposed, you know, and I don't know, maybe is there an argument? You guys know more about this than I do. Like, is the G20 just a bunch of photo ops or does actual work get done there?
Actual work can get done at those. I mean, President Obama, for example, would use them quite often less for the actual individual bilat themselves, but as a, you know, I've got all these guys and gals, that's a horrible way to say that. I've got all these senior leaders in a room. I can actually make progress on something like a Syria statement or something, some other kind of agreement that is going to be useful in some form. We did something on ISIS at a NATO engagement. We've done other things at the G20. It can be an opportunity, but even in the bilats themselves, it can be an opportunity. And even if, mean, quite often when you're one of the folks who's joining the president as a plus one or plus two or plus four at one of these meetings, you may not necessarily be there to speak up much, but you are there for a couple of reasons. One, to show that you are the person that the president trusts to follow up on that negotiation, whatever it is, or two, to honestly take notes and be able to back brief people in a way that is substantively useful. Like if the president of the United States commits, oh, I don't know, that we're going to be able to sell U.S. products to Huawei in a negotiation with Xi, being able to come out of that meeting and tell the rest of the U.S. government what actually happened is a really vital skill. And I don't trust Ivanka or Jared Kushner to be able to do that.
And I think there's also there's value in having those people there because the other leaders plus ones or plus twos or plus fours are also there. And in principle, what you have is the sort of leadership discussions and then the follow-on side discussions that allow you to make sort of incremental process, but also know sort of like, who's your counterpart? What did they do? We all heard the same thing, like have those conversations. And when Ivanka takes that seat, it means the person who's in charge of women's economic empowerment globally or climate change policy or diplomatic relations with China post-trade talks, those people are not in the seat. And I think that's like where you really see costs in the follow-on process.
And that's, if anyone read the transcripts of former Secretary of State Tillerson's meeting with the HVAC and HVAC staff, House Foreign Affairs Committee, it's got a lot of instances of exactly this, where U.S. foreign policy being conducted not by the State Department, not by the National Security Council, but in this case, Jared Kushner. There's no barriers on that. Like, there's nobody who told him, no, you can't do that. It was just permitted, effectively, to circumvent embassies while doing overseas travel. The foreign secretary of Mexico was more than happy to have a bilat with Jared Kushner without telling the State Department while he was right in town. And like, there's no penalties that go with that. They're just more than happy to go along with it.
I mean, that's probably not the first time that like a sort of presidential whisperer has gotten that kind of access, you know, without going through channels, right? I mean, this is the history of, you know, White House senior advisors, you know, but those are always sort of like known problems, right? Like Richard Holbrooke was a known problem, you know, in sort of that role, even though he was firmly ensconced at the State Department, he was there because he wanted to go around, you know, Hillary Clinton and some of the others, right? So this is not a new problem, but especially challenging one given the lack of process elsewhere in the system.
So that's what I was going to say. I think you want it as in addition and in exceptional cases, not as your sort of modus operandi for all foreign policy issues. And I think when you move to that latter model, you end up dropping a lot of balls, but also sort of being subject to, you know, foreign countries being able to kind of engage in strategic manipulation of those leaders, which is kind of...
Oh, 100%, especially if that interlocutor is, in fact, you know, has the ear of the president, but has no background or substantive knowledge or principled position of U.S. foreign policy, but instead perhaps family business.
Plus also financial interest in your country or financial interest that can be manipulated
exactly
by you in your country. Yeah. Hypothetically speaking, I'm just putting that out as a potential.
Yeah, that's another fascinating piece of the Tillerson interview. Is he goes into all of like the possible instances where it made sense, where Kushner was getting all kinds of special treatment, both in his personal financial dealings, but also in U.S. foreign policy.
All right, well, let's shift gears to It's a Guest. Lauren, you mentioned Huawei a second ago, and we'll get to that. But there was an overall China-U.S. bilateral discussion at the G20. And everyone was kind of on tenterhooks waiting to see if there would be a big trade deal, a big trade blow up, or what would happen. Radha, where did that leave us?
So where we ended up was a sort of pause on new tariffs. So folks will recall we have a large number of tariffs already in place on nearly all Chinese goods, but largely on intermediate goods, which affect supply chains, which I can come back to, but not on the sort of direct goods that consumers are purchasing from China. This last round of tariffs after the last trade deal broke down a couple months ago, we're going to go into place and the president froze them with the hopes of bringing the Chinese back to the table to get a new super awesome deal. We don't know what that deal is or what he wants. In particular, it's not totally clear sort of what the exact sticking points were. The president has promised to relax some of the restrictions on Huawei, which folks will remember was sort of caught up in this in two dimensions, which is one on the trade side, but two then on the national security side with concerns on there being national security collection risks from this company collecting information from their technologies and using reporting them back to the Chinese government.
And what the Trump is actually going to allow is for U.S. companies to continue selling components to Huawei itself. So there may still be restrictions on using Huawei technologies here in the U.S., but companies like Google and others will be able to sell their products and services to Huawei, at least for now. Is that right?
That's right. And it keeps it sort of integrated in the Huawei supply chain, which in principle sort of minimizes disruption, sort of in practice. Also means that it doesn't disrupt Huawei's sort of collect. It reduces the pressure on Huawei to adjust their collection efforts or develop alternatives. So where we are is, you know, there need to be a new set of trade talks. Again, the last round sort of really fell apart when the details went to the Chinese and the U.S. got a heavily redlined version. So it will be interesting to see if there's a more substantive process. It'll also be interesting to see, you know, we're now at the point where the supply chains are sort of impacting consumer costs. So there are some estimates that have come out on the cost to consumers of the existing tariffs, not the consumer goods tariffs, but the intermediate goods tariffs. But also there's some evidence that suggests that the supply chain shifts from companies haven't been like to hire to build more U.S. manufacturing, but rather to just move to like Vietnam, which doesn't really do a lot for American jobs and does increase costs, at least for the switching costs. So the whole thing seems to be kind of a mess. I think my big takeaway is like what the Trump administration wants from China in exchange for no tariffs is a fundamental overhaul of the Chinese economy. Like don't have, you know, state-owned enterprise and don't subsidize domestic industries. And those are all sort of laudable goals that have long been parts of U.S. foreign policy. It's not clear, A, the sort of protectionist stance is the most credible way to do that, and B, like what China gets at. It reminds me a little bit of our talking points on Iran, which were like,
yeah, we'll
go back to the Iran deal if, you know, you guys just have a total regime change and let us like run our national security operations from Iran. And, you know, China, if you just adjust your goods and, you know, buy more stuff from us, then yeah, totally, we'll lift your tariffs. Like,
I mean, to be fair on China, right? These are concerns that people have had, you know, dating back. You know, do you remember permanent MFN status? As
I
a
sure do. I was just thinking about this the other day.
So, before, you know, permanent MFN became, you know, permanent normal trade relations (PNTR), which was the sort of forerunner to China becoming a member to the WTO. So, these have been concerns for a while, and they were either hand waved, or people were optimistic, or they thought that we could deal with it, and now, you know, 15, 20 years later, here we are. Do you remember, Radha, on the permanent MFN cards, like who was the House member who was always opposed to extending most favored nation status to China?
Was it Nancy Pelosi?
Nancy Pelosi. That's right. weird things from our high school years. You'd have to read the Kurt Campbell cards to, you know, push her back. Any hoodle, we'll press on from there. So you mentioned Iran, which is very much in the news also. And we'll get to that a little bit more under White House mayhem, but they're also in the news for some trade related things that also came up at the G20. And so the U.S. reimposed sanctions earlier this year, which itself is a violation of the JCPOA, which I think is sort of entertaining. But as part of our withdrawal from that agreement, we reimposed sanctions on Iran, and they've been working with the Europeans to set up some sort of special purpose vehicle or some sort of workaround that would allow them in particular to still sell oil. My understanding is that at the G20, one, China agreed to continue buying that oil, which is interesting. And two, I think ABC News reported that the European mechanism is at least institutionally up and running. There haven't been any oil deals or big credit lines run through it yet, but it is possible to do non-dollar denominated transactions through that mechanism, which might allow the Europeans and Iranians to continue working, which sort of sounds like a good deal if you're kind of in favor of there being additional carrots to keep Iran, you know, pursuing, well, not nuclear weapons. but seems like a giant wedge between the U.S. and the Europeans on a critical security issue and a kind of marginal economic matter. Like, Iran does not matter to the economies of the EU or the United States, but we're like potentially going to go to the mattresses over their, you know, whether we impose secondary sanctions on European allies for doing business with the Iranians, right?
Right. And I mean, this is sort of part of a bigger discussion on the risks and benefits of using economic tools for these types of national security things. So in particular, there's long been this discussion of basically when we use economic sanctions and when we in particular impose really high costs through these secondary sanctions, which are sanctions on people who trade with someone we're sanctioning, entities we're sanctioning, that what we do is create incentives for people to operate in non-dollar denominated transactions. So to use different means of sort of
Euro
engaging in banking
or renminbi or any of these things.
Exactly. And what we do is basically, you know, countries are facing this trade-off where right now the U.S., the dollar currency is the sort of international banking currency, and that has benefits for the U.S. And when we push really hard on these security issues, we create incentives for alternative systems to develop and flourish. And that's what we're seeing here. And if you combine that with this sort of protectionism risk of trade taxes on countries that we're allies with, what we do is create an incentive to have sort of trade clubs of groups of countries that trade together in non-dollar denominated ways to allow them to evade or escape, get out of U.S. Costs on them, either via sanctions or via tariffs from trade. And sort of you end up in these sort of groups of countries that are trading together and aligned on security incentives. And that's kind of what we thought ending that was, what we thought was a critical economic sort of interdependence aspect of the sort of post-war order that is fundamentally stability enhancing. So it's not great.
Oh, good. So we have another set of institutions that we're eroding. I was afraid it was just limited to like NATO and the non-proliferation regimes.
What's funny is for a really long time, you know, we've taken the economic interdependence as both sort of like inevitable and irreversible. And it turns out it's neither.
Neither of those things. Okay. Lauren, I would like you to tell me about some mayhem, perhaps at the White House, dealer's choice, whatever you got.
Well, let's start with Iran, because there's so much going on with Iran. You guys may not have seen this statement. So Iran announced, today is Monday, so Iran announced today, or actually yesterday, that they were going to be increasing their uranium enrichment. And the White House released a statement, this is so beautiful, including the sentence, "There is little doubt that even before the deal, the JCPOA's existence, Iran was violating its terms." So it's like before the deal even existed, somehow Iran was already violating it. And it's just such a beautiful encapsulation of our Iran policy right there.
And definitely encapsulates, you know, how John Bolton thinks of arms control in general, which is that, right?
It's like cheating on your husband before you ever met him.
You know,
that I love that option. The one I came up with on Twitter today was that, like, when you wake up after having a dream and you're mad at your husband for the dream, whatever he did in the dream.
I don't know what you're talking about. I've never done that.
Never done that before, ever. But frankly, that was the least of our concerns like a week ago on Iran, where we were.
We like almost went to war. I've been at work a lot. apparently we almost launched airstrikes against Iran while I was making PowerPoint slides. And
which, you know, nobody would have been totally shocked if that had happened. As folks know, Iran shot down a slightly aging Global Hawk, which I would like to insert in a proposal or an idea in your head is, was that Global Hawk bait? I'm just putting it out there that, like, it had just arrived in the region the day before. It didn't really need to be there. Was it bait? Just gonna throw it out.
I have thoughts on the answer to that question, but I like our restrictions on talking about things that we know about from our actual jobs for the most part, as participate in this podcast. I will say that particular Global Hawk might have just arrived in the region, but Global Hawks in general had been there for quite some time. So that was definitely part of like current ops and like SOP for the last many months.
Totally.
Doesn't mean it couldn't be bait.
So was it bait or just like an excuse to get a new Global Hawk? Like, look, man, need a new plate. It's like when, you know, you wear your best clothes, you wear your old jeans to something really messy. And then you're like, well, I really need a new pair of jeans now.
All right, well, shooting down a global hawk or not, that opens up a whole fascinating line of questions that our good friend Mike Horowitz has been debating about, like, what, how do drones and other unmanned platforms fit into the escalation ladder? And apparently for a little while, it fit into it such that we were going to be employing strikes in Iran that might kill up to 150 people, or at least that's what news reports say. And it's really hard to know exactly what to believe in terms of what comes out of the president's mouth versus what was actually true. But this is a story that it was told that, like, he decided on strikes, and that when he found out the possible casualty numbers, decided to pull them back. Unfortunately, at the last possible minute, after, I guess, in theory, planes were in the air, and fortunately, we were not using assets that could not be turned around in some form, you know.
Which were, like, called missiles.
Which would not have been shocking if we had used them. But there's all kinds of crazy process questions that go with this. Like, why did he find out in theory after that he actually made the decision? I think that it's most likely he had actually heard and either actually changed his mind and was doing this all for show, or he was given squishy numbers the whole time. Because let's face it, John Bolton was running this process, so God knows what was being said. Patrick Shanahan, this was more or less his last day in the office, so there wasn't really, like, strong DOD civilian leadership represented there in this decision-making process, and I don't know. Like,
do we know what Dunford might have weighed in on? I mean, I'm kind of
really want to know, like, what were the CONOPs presented, and who is presenting them, and what were the, like, what happened here? How did we get here?
I mean, but I'm very much, like, in the mind, Radha, of an old line of yours, which is, like, you know, the White House, you would pass things up from Seoul, like, the White House would be like, are you kidding? And your thought was, you should have seen what we kicked back.
That's fair.
Right? And so I have a lot of questions kind of in that vein of, fair, you know, what Tampa originally put forward, you know.
I deeply want to know, like, what were the three COAs? And was this the one that, like, you're definitely supposed to reject for option B? Or was this, like, the actual desired one? Like, seriously,
who knows? I mean, I think, anyway, interestingly, you know, the military, we've talked a lot about some of these, you know, senior military officials who have been Iran hawks, you know, over the years, not the least of which were Secretary Mattis or General McMaster. But then push comes to shove, there's been a fair amount of reporting that they're like, we don't actually want to start a war, which I think is a fascinating sort of policy preference. We would like to be deeply confrontational. I don't even want to get into quote unquote restoring deterrence because there's way too many questions for us to actually answer, you know, on that perspective. But,
guys, we can just use the AUMF for this and we're going to be set.
Oh my God. So are we going to talk about that? Like,
we don't even need to talk about the AUMF, really.
Do it. Go.
I think his lawyers could have easily made the argument that, like, after having shot down our drone, they could have said it was in the national security interest, and they would have come up with some other reason why the president needed to respond to the Iranian threat in some form. That, like, without going to AUMF at all, he would have had the ability to respond in a limited, curtailed strike that was not going to go into war. If it was going to go into war, then he does need other authorities if it's going to last longer than a certain amount of time.
Yeah, I mean, he could still do it under a War Powers Act notification. I mean, assuming that anybody in the White House cares about any of these things.
And then the first two serious strikes, they cared a little. Like, the two legal justifications were, frankly, kind of crappy, but, like, they were there. I could see them coming up with a good one for this Iran strike. It would be plausible. But the fact that the rumors were they were going around briefing the hell about Iran al-Qaeda ties, that should scare the shit out of everybody.
It's Looney Tunes, first of all.
Pretty BS. And second of all, like, that is a fairly obvious attempt to try to bring Iran into the AUMF category such that we can just add them into the 39 million people they're at war with at this point in time. Most of whom we don't even have in public, the public space right now, are not actually even public adversaries of the United States. We just are at war with them quietly.
I know. Does a deep part of you just want to do a little tutorial on, like, Shias and Sunnis and different extremist groups and state-sponsored actions and the history of Iran and al-Qaeda, which there is some sort of questionable support, but not that could follow on the AUMF. My one thought on the AUMF, which I will just leave us with, is I do feel like if we can get Iran into the AUMF for the post-9/11, you know, Taliban AUMF, then we should just be like, we can just kill terrorists whenever we want. We're just going to call them terrorists. We're going to shoot them down. They can be sponsored by the state. They can be not. And there is no congressional notification. The executive branch just has authority for all of the wars all of the time forever. And we'll all go home.
I mean, I think the executive branch already believes that. I mean, it's also interesting to note that Iran provided some pretty significant cooperation very quietly in the early days of the war on terror.
They did.
To counter the Taliban and to counter the Al-Qaeda presence in Afghanistan. But yeah, I mean, you know, I think the one version of this answer is that maybe that means the AUMF needs to go and that we should have some other legal regime for how we want to handle all of these things going forward. Because it turns out that expansive executive powers continue to expand.
Yes, absolutely. We need to come up with a better legal regime for executing everything the executive branch wants to do in terms of going to war. However, that can be the only restraint on them. Like Congress needs to be able to talk about why it's bad to go to war, not just for legal reasons, because when you start talking about everything you can do legally, there's a lot we can do legally. So let's find ways to curtail our strength in other forms.
So, Lauren, you mentioned Pat Shanahan in his last day in the office, our once and future Secretary of Defense. It turns out he was never nominated. He was the acting secretary for 6 months, but his nomination package was never sent to Capitol Hill. And then somewhere in background investigations that surely should have been discovered when he was the nominee for DepSec, they discovered a number of troubling allegations and some pretty unfortunate family dynamics going on within the Shanahan family writ large. So now we are in some sort of crazy roulette wheel of actings and performing the duties of and whatever. So currently, Mark Esper, formerly the Secretary of the Army, is the acting SecDef. Should he become the nominee, he has to step aside, correct?
That is right.
Because that's, I mean, assuming we decide to follow the Vacancies Act, which I think is still kind of up in the air. But let's say that happens. If Esper is formally nominated, then what happens next?
So then he goes back to his day job of being Secretary of the Army. And in theory, according to the DOD line of succession, we would have Secretary of the Navy Richard Spencer, not the white nationalist, but the other Richard Spencer.
Then
become acting Secretary of Defense. The acting Deputy Secretary of Defense, which let's remember we don't have either a secretary or a deputy, would remain David Norquist. He is the comptroller.
I think he's performing the duties of, actually, which is a very weird and minor distinction that matters to seven lawyers in Washington, D.C.
Exactly. There was discussion that he was going to be nominated to be the permanent deputy, but the rumor was part of the package deal. If we're going to nominate Shanahan, Inhofe would only accept that if we nominated Norquist as well. So now that Shanahan's gone, I'm curious whether this Norquist deal remains. And then
Ryan
McCarthy, who is Undersecretary of the Army, and as I mentioned last time, a former special assistant peer of mine when I worked for Bob Gates, he will be nominated to be Secretary of the Army. So, you know, I'm feeling a little slow.
On the plus side, you don't have to work in the Trump administration. So,
or be the Secretary of the Army.
Also that, I mean, this administration is very good at making announcements. They are not really apparently very great at putting together personnel packages and sending them to Capitol Hill. And the Senate's about to be on, I mean, the August recess is coming up here soon. So it'll be interesting to see if any of these folks get into their slots before that, or if we have to wait till after Labor Day for these things to happen.
Yeah. Mark Milley will have his hearing in, I think, the next 2 weeks, but he will not turn over to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs until, I think it's the beginning of September is the planned transition date at that point.
That's right. So while we are observing all these vacancies in turn on the civilian side, we're also looking to get a new chairman of the Joint Chiefs and a vice chairman, which on the one hand would be sort of like just usual like DC parlor games, like kind of guessing like, you know, who's still standing when the music stops or whatever. On the other hand, we almost went to war last week and we aren't really sure who presented the options and who has the authorities to do what. And so these things become more than a little bureaucratic when, you know, somebody has to present the president with complex military options or make decisions or notify parents that their sons and daughters have been killed in action. I mean, these things get real pretty fast. And we have not one, but several crises going on around the world at the moment. So it's a little rough.
And I will say that DOD's in bad shape, but they are not even the worst off department. DHS also has a right. number of important vacancies and continuing to grow with a number of acting heads of agencies that are in charge of all sorts of important and controversial security and border related issues, as well as overall homeland security issues. So, you know, I think DOD is what we focus on because of our backgrounds, but it's not great, guys. It's not great.
What is great, however, is our summer reading list, if we can shift gears to pop culture. Do you guys like that transition?
I did.
Looking forward to it.
Good work.
I'm no Shane Harris, but you know, I do what I can on the transitions. So Lauren did excellent legwork and corralled our many previous guests and also her co-hosts to submit books for this summer's bombshell reading list. We'll include the link again in the show notes. It's a fabulous list. Our guests are women of exquisite and refined taste, as if we didn't already know that. But there's a very nice mix of fiction and nonfiction and serious and not so serious. And I don't know, people should read it. It's very good.
I know it's really handy to have a sort of escapist list where you can also learn things. So I feel like it's got a good totally. Mix of.
I told you guys it has a basic theme of Ireland, World War II, and spies.
I'm here for all of that. That sounds about. I'm trying to get through Milkman right now, which is this year's Booker winner. And I think I said on Twitter that like I have a very love-hate relationship with the Booker winners. And this one is not tending toward love. It's not quite into like Luminaries territory of like bugging the shit out of me. But it definitely works better to like read for kind of an hour at the beach and then put it aside as opposed to like trying to read it at night and figure out like, oh, what is going on here? So
yeah, I have like a similar, I'm working my way through Elliot Ackerman's new book, which is interesting.
Oh, nice.
Sort of juxtaposition of his time as a Marine and his time as a journalist. He had a really excellent piece on the Battle of Fallujah, I think after Memorial Day, that I highly recommend. I think it was in the New York Times. Sort of alternating that between Emily Oster's new book on parenting and data-driven stuff for toddlers, which is really handy on things like if you want to know all of the evidence on potty training or sleep training or, you know, whatever. But you can't really read too much of either one of them without wanting to go insane. So, you know, that summarizes my life right there.
I am presently reading two things, White House Warriors by John Ganz, a former DOD colleague who was an Ash Carter speechwriter, amongst other positions. It's basically a history of the modern NSC. And I was, as I told you guys, like if people thought that there was micromanaging under Obama, they have absolutely no idea what was going on under like the Kennedy and Nixon administrations. My God, there were shenanigans. I'm also reading an amazing book called The 7.5 Deaths of Evelyn Hardcastle. The description of the book is actually perfect. It is a combination of Agatha Christie, Downton Abbey, Quantum Leap, and Groundhog Day. And that's exactly precise. And like, can you imagine a better mix of things?
Yeah, I was like, well, I should read that. Throw out my
yeah. I mean, I'm like flying to Kansas City later this week, so maybe that needs to be on the list. I did also hear on NPR, of course, because that's exactly who I am, that there is a new update of Hamlet focused on Ophelia. Did you guys hear this? With Daisy Ridley as the lead, right? So
and focused from the Ophelia point of view, which sounds super interesting.
Exactly. And so I you know. Unclear that I'm going to be able to take my nieces to see that, but maybe I'll be able to see that on my own here in sunny Southern California at some point. So congratulations. We have successfully rehashed the podcast we recorded 36 hours ago. Nice job, everyone. Minorly more informed. Mostly, I just think that we're brilliant and it's amazing that we're able to pull this off, despite the fact that we are not audio engineers. So
plus, we all have great hair, so...
Yes.
Wins all around.
Continue drinking your things or not drinking your things as you see fit. And we'll see everyone again here in a couple weeks. Bye.